Here we go. All right, everybody got a sheet? Okay, we're going to be going there. Okay, I just, Rabbi Feldman has a pretty nice outline. I'm just going to use that and use it in, of course, ad lib to teach some basic principles, which will go into, you know, really the practical elements of koshering a kitchen, maintaining a kosher kitchen. And it's going to go on, and of course it'll bring into a whole series of practical elements here. Okay, so I want to deal with like a basic question is like why do we, if you go into a kosher, what are some of the signature features of a kosher kitchen?
Two dishwashers.
Okay.
Two sets of dishes.
Two sets of dishes. So let's start with that. Why do you need two sets of dishes? But if you look at the fork, there's not a piece of meat stuck in it when I'm going to have, I mean,
the residue.
So let me just, you know, rinse it off and then,
not good enough.
Apparently it's not good enough. Well, the question, okay, so we have to,
Told
we have
about to, temperature.
Okay, so the, okay, so there's a, so you need, in order to understand that, to appreciate there's, we have to, learn a couple of concepts. The first concept, which is on page one there, which is called Tom Kicker. The principle we're going to talk about is Ta'am Ki'ikar. Ta'am means what? Ta'am.
Taste,
correct. Ki'ikar. What is the word ikar? Veha ikar. Veha ikar.
The main thing.
Ta'am Ki'ikar. Okay? So, there's a debate in the Talmud about in order that that food is composed of two components. There's the substance and there's the flavor. Right, and therefore, and we have an idea that flavor can be, you know, infused into other things. That's why part of cooking is the art of infusing various flavors of one food, one substance, into other substance to infuse the food flavor infusion. Okay, so the conclusion is that we say that Tom Kicker, that the infusion of flavor is like the very essence. Or you would think, in order for something to be truly partake of, it's already to be something truly having the quality of meat, you'd have to have the physical muscle tissue and the flavor. You need to have both components. So the conclusion among the debate is that even Tom Kicker, even having the flavor, is sufficient to give its identity, that this is now also meat. That in order, the meat flavor equals meat. Okay?
Stuff we had downstairs
at
the tacos. That was meat.
No, that was vegetarian.
No, but I'm going off at point.
No, so if that
because the taste is enough, you just said.
No, so I'm saying. Well, no, what I no, I'm saying. So what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like this: that if, for example, I cook a stew, a chalent, in a pot, I take it all out, and I cook, something else. There can be an issue of the flavor of the meat will be infused into the next dish. For example, in cooking, chefs like to use frying pans, which are what's it term? It's a certain kind of
skillet.
Right, a certain kind of skillet made of a certain kind of old kind of
cast iron.
Thank you, a cast iron skillet, because the cast iron skillet, it absorbs the flavor of the pre-thing. So therefore, the older it is, the better, because it adds a little dimension of flavor to your cooked dish. Okay? So, halachically, now again, does that mean every single time chemically that's happening? No, because halacha, this is a very important principle, does not go by a chemical reality. It goes by sense perception. What you know what I mean? Doesn't go by, you know what I'm saying? And therefore, whether or not actually in that particular case there was a transference of flavor, it makes it, because legally we define it as, we assume there was flavor transferred there, okay? Do you guys follow me on that one?
Sorry, but here's a question. So theoretically, glass can be both?
So glass, interesting debate. So glass, there's a debate now, does certain substances absorb? Or do they also exude? So for example, that's a debate about the nature of glass. So the Sephardim way the custom of the song is to accept the Rishonim, the early rabbis, medieval rabbis, that say that it's neither absorbs nor infuses.
Right.
So therefore, it's always parv. So if I cook steak on it, if I cook up steak in a glass, you know, tray, and I wash the substance off, make it perfectly clean, I can cook, tuna casserole, tuna cheese casserole, no problem. It's not porous, it does not infuse, it does not send out, okay? So that's the first concept, is tam k'ikar.
But then here's my question. So stainless steel, theoretically, isn't porous, it's not absorbing, but it's a theory that the film stays on it?
So the question is this. That's a very good point. Now, as, you know, new materials are developed, again, it's not so easy to apply the properties of the Talmud's metals to our refined metals. Mm-hmm. So it could very well be that factually, so let's see. So the way that Herschel Schachter was one of the Rosh Yeshiva YU, for example, by glass. So therefore, we know chemically glass is impervious to absorbent. That's why you use glass in chemistry. Because you know that you do an experiment, the chemicals don't go in, and that's it. So therefore, in certain cases, that we're going to be very lenient because we know pragmatically, from a utilitarian fan, ain't nothing happening, and that one position is correct. Even we as Ashkenazim are strict. So in cases of doubt, we're going to be more lenient. You know what I'm saying? Do you know what I'm saying? This is sort of a collision between, let's call it halachic sense perception reality versus chemical reality. Do you understand there's a distinction there necessarily? So you have a good example. Let's say you have stainless steel that in fact might have the same property, I don't know, I'm not a chemist, as, let's say, glass that does not absorb at all. And the fact if you're able to fully clean it, so that's another question. It also wasn't that they didn't have the sufficient levels of thing, that there was always some residue left over also, this additional thing. Not just flavor, but actual a film of substance, grease, a little bit of grease left over.
Right, but so I guess that's my question. It's like if you're in a situation where you don't have a separate pot or pan, right, and you know that they're cooking with stainless,
can't be lenient. We don't treat. First of all, I don't know if stainless steel is in fact that. I don't know if that are the properties. I do know that by glass. I don't know if does stainless steel have any absorption power at all. I don't. Luckily, we treat it as. We don't distinguish between metals, and therefore we assume that there is a situation of absorption. Now, let me just so here's a key point. So let's take a case of our similar situation. You have a regular meat skillet, okay, and I fry up a steak. So even if I clean it off, that we assume that there's been some absorption into that thing, okay. So that's what they call. The Hebrew term is no saint tam. It was no tainus to give. It gave flavor into the thing. That's one no taint tam, giving a flavor into the pot. I take potatoes. I clean it off so there's no grease. I fry up potatoes. So there's another flavor going from the pan back into the thing. That's a second knot. So therefore, can I eat, what would you say, can I eat those potatoes now with sour cream?
No. Yeah.
I think you can.
So.
You're saying they're cooked in a meat pot, but it's just potatoes.
No, so potatoes themselves are parv, right? There's no, they're not, you're right?
But if they're in a meat pot, then they become meat. Because of.
All right, so we don't, so. So,
technically, they're not lemon, garlic, or onions, or whatever.
Right. So the thing is like this. That so here's the thing. So that there's a debate. No. So if you look at
the
items,
if the thing has been used in the past like 24 hours,
we're gonna get this. So we have all these three items here. Look at 1, 2, and 3. So I'm gonna go to 3 first. I cook par potato in a meat pot. It's not bar not second degree. Taste does not have the potency to create a milk and meat mixture. And I can eat the potato cooked with a meat pot on a dairy dish or with sour cream, but we don't. So halachically, if you mixed it by accident, the sour cream, you could eat it. Sfardim could, there are certain distinctions in certain areas that Sfardim are more lenient, have a lenient position. Sometimes Sfardim have the more strict position. If it already was mixed, you could eat it. We Ashkenazim. Sfarim, if you fry it up in a meat pot and it's clean, you could eat it. You could go ahead and eat it together with sour cream. So it's two tongs. It's one. When you have no, it's not bar not, and then it comes together with the opposite dairy meat and dairy. Then the Sfarim say you can eat it together. We Ashkenazim do not. If it was mixed in after the fact, we do eat it. Okay. What's the takeaway? If mistakes happen in the kitchen, do not throw out the food. Invariably, there's a rich distinction between doing things the ideal way, what they call Hebrew, lechatchila, initially, ab initio, if you want to use a fancy word. And there's things that, after the fact, I made a mistake, what do I do now? So if a mixture happened, then I could, you know, more often than not, I could then eat the food. Things may have to be koshered sometimes, but the food invariably, not always, is still kosher.
But you're eating it on a dairy dish.
So, okay, so let's go. I'm gonna go through another scenario. So I have if I have my fried potatoes. You can definitely put it on a dairy dish, always.
Right, but I
mean, they don't magically become meat. They possibly have second degree flavor of meat. Okay. Meat went into the pot and pan, then it went back into the thing. And the question is, that level, do I have to be concerned about that or not? The Sfarim say no, because there's a debate in the Talmud, and there we Ashkenazim end on. Initially, we treat it as being strict. If there was a mix up, we still eat it. Okay, everybody holds you can definitely eat the meat equipment potatoes on a dairy dish with a dairy fork and knife. No problem. You guys follow me on this so far?
That's why you can do almond milk because it's dairy equipment, but it's right. Definitely not dairy.
Correct. Same concept.
Same principle.
Same button. All right. So this is a principle in a lot of elements of the practical, you know, kosher kitchen issues. Now let me go back to a very important point that Sean shared. How long does the flavor? Now, even if you want to say the flavor is absorbed into the, you know, to the knife, the fork, you know, thing. How long is the flavor still potent?
24 hours.
24 hours. At that point, we say the flavor is. If there's any flavor, it's certainly spoiled. And we call it no saying tom lifgam. The flavor which has been infused is now spoiled. Because food does not have a infinite shelf life, certainly something as delicate as a flavor, at a certain point, is going to be gone. What does it mean practically? So if I fried up potatoes in a meat pot, and it was clean, and I hadn't been used for 24 hours, and then I realized that I could go ahead and put the cream cheese on it.
So technically, you only need one set of dishes. Mm-hmm. On a technical level,
biblically, for sure. Let me explain that. What Shira brought up is an excellent point, a very important concept. Biblically, all pots and pans, everything becomes parv in 24 hours. So the question is, so very simply, I'll just, date stamp my pots, pitches, you know, for 24 hours. So you can obviously understand why the rabbis came along. They said they made a rabbinic legislation, a gezerah. They made... You cannot use a eino ben yomo. I can't take my meat pot, my chal pot, and wait 24 hours and make cheese casserole in there, because what is the concern? That I'm going to make a mistake, and I'm going to do it not 24 hours, but 10 hours. And that's going to be a problem, because then I'm going to have real fresh meat flavor being infused into my cheese casserole, which will be a biblical problem of, meat and milk, which is a biblical violation, okay? So therefore, that's the reason that initially you have to have designated dishes for meat, dishes for dairy, and ideally we'll get to some reasons to even have some things for parv as well, okay? I'm going to stop right there. So those are the three basic points. We have tom ke iker, the flavor has an essential quality of the food itself, A. Not bar not, even if it goes a second degree, it goes in and then comes out to the next thing, it's still an issue, at least initially. Second concept is that the flavor has a 24-hour shelf life. So how does I trust myself that if I did make a mistake, if I made a mistake, for example, let's say I did take that chomp pod and I made a big boo-boo, and I've done all these mistakes. Okay, there's always a source of friction in the world. You know, when a guy comes in and does cooking and makes a mistake and so if I did take the chalent pot and meat pot and I make cheese casserole, and it was after 24 hours, the cheese casserole is permitted because the flavor is not dead. But anything that has the flavors or the orientation of both meat and milk, you need to do what? You need to kosher it. Has to be kosher. Has to be sort of koshering. Fundamentally, is going through another cooking process, which basically is a process of basically reformatting the identity of the pot.
Does this all assume that thoroughly clean, the pan or whatever you're using is thoroughly clean?
Yes. Obviously, there's still substance stuck to it. So, has anybody lived with the messy roommate?
Yeah,
with
my brothers.
Okay, so I'll tell you a story. So I was using them in Yeshiva dorm. Okay? We did our own cooking. So we did worse. So we weren't big on the cleaning part. So one time. So what happened was, guys fried up a cheese omelet. And then just and left it there still. And then somebody else cooked. And one time, it all got stacked up, because when you stack up dishes, I'm going to get to this. They stacked it up. It was meat, dairy, meat, dairy, meat, dairy. Somebody walked by the oven, and I see the stove pot, the stove top was on. And there's there's layers of meat, dairy pots and pans with the fire going on. So they're all melting into each other, the grease back and forth. So I had the unfortunate job, because I was a dorm counselor, so I had to bring this halachic question to the Rosh Hashiva, and he was really not happy, because if you're really a pig, and guys can be pigs, if you have a very neat kitchen, the chance of you having a halachic problem, very slow. Because the problem is going to be if you have grease of meat and grease that's still around, or a person spills some coffee and it doesn't get wiped up. But if you have a very clean kitchen, likely you're not going to have a halacha problem pretty much ever. But guys are pigs.
My college roommates were
okay, but this was very disgusting. This was actually full-on disgusting. And, so it was a combination of pigs, lazy pigs. Lazy, careless pigs. So it created this was a halacha problem that you'd have to think up to be able to construct. Because just sheer piggery, they created this whole mess, and it was like a Buster McCullough meat and milk catastrophe.
Did you have to re-kosher everything?
Well, some stuff, if it's Teflon, it's not easily, can't kosher, so it'd be chucked out. So, kind of like that, but it was basically, it had to be a whole policy change that basically there had to be the level of hygiene to be brought up, so therefore they wouldn't have these massive halachic problems that they're self-inflicting on themselves.
Did I have a bug problem?
What?
Bug problem with that.
I understand that, but this is, college age guys just in a dorm is just, yeah. Anyways, I'd say, yes, question.
Well,
any question?
Yeah.
All right.
Can I actually ask a question that you just said? You said yeah. Teflon?
Yeah.
Can you use Teflon?
Sure.
I thought nonstick pans you can't use.
Sure, you can use Teflon. Use them all the time. The question is that since Teflon is a, it gets into our next issue. And koshering, which we can get to 1.1 and 2 here, is the issue that that when you have materials that did not exist in the time of the Talmud, how do you apply the principles? Is it something that absorbs? Does it not absorb? Basically, in the time of the Talmud, they had basically three basic things. You had metal. You had glass, and you had earthenware. Earthenware was something that was very porous. It definitely absorbed ceramic stuff. That was their throw. If you go, we went to, you guys remember when you guys went to Shiloh? Did you guys see all the pottery shards?
Yeah.
So that was their throwaway disposable things. They had very simple, what they would do is they would make very simple, like, basic things, and then they would, like, they would shatter them. It would be, like, very crude earthenware things. That was, like, their disposable stuff, okay? Not fine stuff, okay? So the earthenware stuff had the quality of absorbing. It's very porous, definitely absorbed, and it's unclear if all the stuff came out. So therefore, if you trafed a earthenware thing, true today, or a ceramic thing, you can't kosher it. You got to chuck it. Or better yet, give it to your non-Jewish friend. Do that. Okay, so that's ceramic. Okay, so question about plastic and Teflon, all things, it all becomes a question. Question.
Can you say again what
not bar not means? Not means, not is short for notain tum. So the first letter of each word is nun, tet, so notain tum, so not bar not. So not bar not, the hetera of kosher food, is initially, in the opposite, we try to not put them together. But if it got mixed, so if I cook up potatoes in the meat pan that was used within the last 24 hours, we shouldn't try not to put sour cream on them or butter. But if I did already, I may do so. If it was already out 24 hours, and I know about that, then I can't fry them with that event. But if I have the potatoes and I desire to have dairy, then I can. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about some... the goal here is to take a little helicopter ride onto all these things. All right, here we go. Kosher utensils. So we get, this is a biblical thing. The Jews went on a campaign against the armies of Midian. They brought back all their vessels. So they had to go through a process of koshering because they had all the, you know, the Midianites were grilling pork and all that kind of stuff. So it says, the basic principle is kachbolo kachpolto. Bottom line of number one. The way it goes in is the way it goes out.
That's how you kosher on Pesach, right?
That's how you kosher all year round, but koshering, really, people show up on Pesach because people want to use some of their throughout the year thing. So let me explain that. So the way that it comes in contact with the food. So for example, if I have a pot, I usually use that pot. I cook with liquid. I put a soup in there, right? In other words, pots are usually cooking through a liquid medium. So that if I want to kosher the pot, say for Pesach, or I made it non-kosher because I made a mistake, so therefore I clean it. I let it sit for a day, so it's ein ben yomo. It's all tam is now lifgam, right? It's been spoiled. And then I fill up the pot till the rim. I bring up to a rolling boil, and there's an idea of getting, since you want to get even the rim part, top of the rim, you take a little rock, you heat that one up, and you put it in, and so it goes over the top of the rim. So you kosher the entire surface, the internal surface, and the rim as well. That's how you... So the way that the flavor... Let's say I cooked up veal parmesan. Real, non-kosher veal with cheese. Gesunte non-kosher. And I want to kosher that pot up. No problem. Clean it off. Perfectly. Nothing, no residue left. Let it sit for 24 hours. Fill it up with the top thing. Bring it to a rolling boil. Take like a stone. Heat that up. So therefore you drop it in, it won't drop the temperature down. It will cause the water to overflow, so the rim gets in contact with the water. I now have koshered my pot, okay? So the way that the flavor came in is the way the flavor is now pulled out.
Is there anything that can't be koshered?
I'm going to get into that right now. Look on page 2. So metal, so pots and frying pans, regular frying pans, which are metal without Teflon, no, same way, okay? Whatever, so the way that, there is another way of... Have you seen the blowtorch method? If something comes directly in contact with food, let's say, for example, a classic example is a barbecue grill. So you need to bring it to a temperature which is called libun, literally making it white hot, which is the that if you heat it up, that if I would put a, if there's two kinds of libun. There's a libun kal, a lower level, where if I touch like a little rag or straw, it'll burn up, or actually becomes red hot. The best way to deal with that, for example, is to put things in self-cleaning ovens. Anyone have a self-cleaning oven? So that gets up to like 800-900 degrees. You just put the thing in there, let it go through a cycle, that is done, you've done libun chamur, and that koshers everything, okay? You know, all metals, okay? So if I have racks, which I use for barbecuing, and let's say somebody gave me a barbecue, and it was they grilled pork chops on it. No problem. I don't even have to clean it. I can just, if I do Liban, any flavor, any something considered to be completely eviscerated, destroyed by the power of the heat. It's what I call libun chazak. It's strong, making it white hot. Okay?
Wait, can you just go back to what you just said about the stone and the water?
Yes.
How long do you boil it for?
1 second. Once it hits a rolling boil and I overflow, that's it, done.
Okay.
It's instant. Again, it goes by legal status. Have you cooked out the flavor? Yes. I assume that thing. Again, it doesn't go by necessarily the physical reality, it goes by the legal reality. Or the legal assumption
and
reality.
If you're dipping something in a boiling pot of water, i.e. like a smaller pot in a larger pot.
Yeah, just drop it for 1 second.
And just pick it up.
Well, I would not pick it up. I would turn off the thing. I would wait till it cools.
Right, okay.
But yeah, you can just take it out, correct. For example, let's say somebody gives you, non-Jewish person gives you a beautiful, or non-observant person gives you a beautiful set of flatware. Perfectly clean. But known clearly that they were not kosher observant. Very simple. So if you have a beautiful set of silverware, you say thank you so much. You just caution them. You get yourself a nice, flacious big pot, roll it to roll and boil, and you just drop the silver in one at a time. Boom.
A flacious pot?
Well, a flacious is a Yiddish for meat.
No, I know what it is, but
you keep it, to make it very simple, there are some complexity. In other words, if I'm going to use those dishes for those silverware for meat, it could be any pot.
Okay.
It could be any pot, technically. But just keep it simple. I like to make it like sort of like... mistake proof.
Well, but what if you're planning on using
dairy?
You
still could.
You couldn't do it in a meat pot.
You still could put it in a meat pot, but make sure the meat pot has been not been used for 24 hours. Okay, then you're definitely no problem. Okay, oftentimes people get very fine china. You know, like Lennox. Really, the stuff is like $200 a setting. And so what's available? The problem is earthenware, so that seems to be not kosherable. So coming long story short, that if it hasn't been used for a year, dip it into boiling water 3 times. There's a leniency that applies to that. Okay? You should know that. Glass, quartus fardum, they don't have to kosher it earthenware because essentially it's what? It's doesn't absorb anything. Doesn't include anything.
Something's monetary value affect its like.
Sentimental value, like your grandparents' dishes.
No, halach. No. Sean will bring up a good point. In other words, if the law is the law, the law is the law. No, because many things there's a debate. So in general, when there's a thing called a hefsed meruba, a massive financial loss. We had a halachic question. Somebody sent in their selling their chametz after the time. So the chametz was not sold. And they had a lot of scotch. Hundreds of dollars of scotch and bourbon. So literally owned chametz. So chametz is owned by a Jew over Pesach is not permitted in any kind of benefit. So that's called a massive financial loss. They're literally going to have to take all these bottles of 30-year-old scotch, pour it down the drain. So under certain the financial situation does play a role, so which means that you can, under certain circumstances, you can rely on the minority. In general, if it's going to cost you $4, you're not going to rely on the minority opinion. But if it's going to cost you $5,000, then for you is a massive financial loss that gives you discretion to rely upon a lenient position. Do you understand that?
So he was granted leniency, even though
What we do is to remove the biblical problem. It's called, we do bittul, make the declaration. Any chametz that I own, right. I know by now, should be like ownerless like the dust of the earth. So that's making so that biblically makes it not I didn't own it biblically, so there may be a rabbinic issue. So question, when the issue becomes a rabbinic issue, there's a lot more room to negotiate. Because they built in, the rabbis themselves, when they made their legislation, they built in certain loopholes itself to have situations of extenuating circumstances. Okay? So therefore, what the circumstances plays an enormous role. One distinction is that, can I rely upon a minority opinion? If it's going to be if the loss is $4, the answer is no. You know what I mean? If the person is like, you're going to get into a mega fight with mom and dad, that has halachic significance. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So for a time, you would dip it 3 times in boiling water, let it sit for a year.
Or let it sit for a year and then dip it, yeah.
No. So So either way, it just doesn't sit for a year in some fashion.
Yeah, because according to an opinion or two, that after a year, any possible, it becomes intrinsically, not you know, the, it's all the flavor is completely done, and it's like goes back to like it's like it's made new. It's like basically a reset button. So.
What about wine glasses that theoretically had unkosher wine?
So that's not a problem because they're not.
It's glass.
It's glass, and also it's not, because again, part of flavor is infused into another thing through the medium of heat.
Right. Okay.
Biblically, rabbinically, if it sits there for at least 24 hours, so it's not going to be an issue. And glass, not a problem. So you just wash them off. Now, also, you guys know that if you buy a new stuff, you need to take it to the mikveh. Glass and metal have to be immersed in a mikveh.
They
call it toivling? Called toivling. Tfilat kelim.
So what if it's pre-toivled? So, like, what if you get the best. Already... So that's fine.
If you know the person did it, yeah.
I mean, like, you can buy pre-toivled.
Fine, so that's great.
Okay, so you can rely on the manufacturer if it says it's been toivled.
If it says, if it's a Jewish manufacturer and they said toivled, yeah, of course, yeah. I assume they're not lying to you. You don't have to assume they're lying to you. Okay.
Do you have to toivel it, or is it more of like a spiritual thing?
It's a require. You can't use it until you toivel.
Okay.
Okay. Many modern Orthodox are not aware of this. Sort of. This becomes like sort of like. Now the idea is, what's the idea? If somebody asks you, what the heck are you doing, taking your glasses and your knives to the thing? So let me tell you the concept in 25. You know, the 25-cent answer. The 25-cent answer is like this: that any vessel that's made by a Jew, let's say Shearwood make a, she's a an artisan, and she makes some customized steak knives, I don't have to tell them. They're made by a Jew. They're made by a non-Jew. We assume that in their construction, in the creation, is their it's created under the framework of their cultural mentality toward food, and what is the cultural mentality of food in the world is basically food is there, you know, is a good in its own right. The good of food is to basically is to enjoy food for its own sake. We maintain that food, as we learned in the last couple of weeks, that food is instrumental to a spiritual goal. So therefore, by bringing it to the mikvah, I'm going like a sort of like I'm koshering it. I'm giving its new identity. I'm now giving its new halachic status. It's now oriented toward the Jewish ideals of food. So that's the thing. So therefore, you go to Israel, if it's made by a Jewish artisan, you don't have to tovel it, because it's assumed that it's part of the same cultural identity. If it's made by a non-Jew, it's assumed it has a non-Jewish mentality toward food. Therefore, you have to bring it to the mikveh. That's the basic idea. And on the west side, there is a west side mikveh. They have what they call a kalim mikveh, a mikveh made for the immersion of these dishes. Yes, question.
Oh, I thought that'd be really good senior fellowship.
You want to go to the mikveh thing? We can only do it by day. You can't go to the mikveh at night because then it's like, because the women are going there. And
it's like Sunday afternoon.
Sunday day. It has to be a day thing. Yeah, we have to go. Well, all right, that's a good idea. We had a fantastic, by the way, you guys, it was a great epic trip. I took the fellows to, fantastic. Went all through Whole Food.
Did you guys bond?
We did bond.
Did you have a wine tasting?
We had no wine tasting. The person literally, I was running after them for like 6 weeks, and they just emailed me today. Oh, you didn't give it to you. Anyways, we had no, so you guys got the better one. But I did the tour. All right, let's keep on going. Plastic. There's an issue whether or not plastic is towable. If plastic gets trafed up, chuck it. It's typically very cheap. Next, ovens.
Wait, why Pyrex? Why is the exception?
Pyrex is really, because Pyrex is a combination of glass and sort of a, no, it's...
Meaning it holds the same status as glass, or it doesn't?
I don't know why he put that. I mean,
So you toggle it?
You toggle it. You toggle it.
If you have a Pyrex meat dish, it can't be both?
Ashkenazim are typically strict. If you came into it, some families always use glass for both, that's fine. But again, I would not, again, that's a good example. I would not like, that's a classic example. I would not hock somebody if they're being lenient in glass, you know what I'm saying? Because that is a divide between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and then really it's a stringency for Ashkenazim. So you got to like, if you go to a Sephardic person's table, I would not like, and they're using their plates, and they serve the previous meal dairy on the same plates, I would just let it go.
So would you eat it? Yes. Like,
Yes. Yes. Not because also, by the way, it's another thing. Embarrassment. A person embarrassed, a person in public has no portion of the world to come. So that's also a law consideration. That doesn't mean because you want to, because to avoid embarrassment you can't eat non-kosher. But again, areas where there's a debate and there's a legitimate position, you can be lenient for. I told the MG fellows, I said, look, you know, all things being equal, I live in New York City, I'm going to have glatt kosher OU meat. I go to somebody's house, they're using Hebrew National, which has a triangle K, which is not glatt, I'm not going to embarrass, I would eat that. Because technically, Ashkenazim do not have to have the stringency of glatt. Really, it's only a Sephardim and Hasidim absorb that. And B, that hashgach is certainly good enough to rely upon, you know, say, in a pinch. You know what I'm saying? So that's an example. Like, I go to a person's house, and it's like a relative, and they feel so good about it, and you're going to say, can't do that. You know what I'm saying? But it doesn't mean I can eat, like, Swanson's. Okay, because I don't want to embarrass them. So I'm, you know, that's it. Do you understand the thing? Like, the basic general rule is that provided there is a legitimate halachic position that they stand in, even though maybe not the majority, but you're gonna shalom is a very important point. That's a very important principle. And also, there's another concept: hamachmir yachmir l'atzmo. A person who's strict should be strict for themselves. For example, so I grew up in a certain yeshiva, in a certain environment, so I keep certain stringency that I grew up with. And I, like, for example, on Pesach, I only eat shmura matzah all 7 days. So I don't make my kids do that. It's my own strength. Okay, fine. That's my strength because it's really according to the Rambam. So why should they have to, you know, why, there's no point to that. So Maki Zeo, you have to have only Shmuel and Matzah.
Do you
eat Gebrachs? I will have Gebrachs if it's made out of Shmuel and Matzah. But that's, there's not really a market for that because typically people eat Shmuel and Matzah also don't eat Gebrachs.
Right.
So it's a weird variation. I grew up not eating Gebrachs. So that was my family's custom. Not even matzah even cooked on Pesach. It's a very common in the Hasidic and even Yeshivish world.
No matzah brei.
No matzah brei, for example, yes.
Till the 8th day.
Right? Till the 8th day, yes. Or I do eat pizza. That, right, no matzah pizza, all the good stuff.
But you don't eat anything cooked on matzah?
I do. I'm saying when I grew up as a kid, I grew up, my family was a little sort of like, I would say call it like little Hasidishes, Hasidic a little bit. Less over time. Okay. Now, ovens. Okay, very simply. An oven. Okay, so first of all, let's say you're going over to your friend's house, got a treif oven. Can you use it?
You can
cook it in lots of tinfoil.
So if you double wrap your food, no problem. Or if it's something which is not steamy, you could put 2 sheets of tinfoil and then cook it, as long as it's not going to be filled with, you know, fill up the thing with, you know, not splattering and fill with steam. You can use their non-kosher oven. Not a problem. You can use a non-kosher oven. If you want a kosher oven to be able to, you know, be able to roast and open, you know, without having to either fully, you know, close it or have all these kind of restrictions, you just have to fully, you know, very simple. If you have a self-heating oven, you just put the self-heating oven cycle on, and you come back in the morning, and it's kosher. That's the best. If you don't have a self-cleaning, it's a real pain. Because basically, you got to easy up the thing, you got to make sure it's got no junk the thing over, then you got to, you know, let it sit for a day, and then put it on for an hour at the highest temperature. Okay? Some people are even more strict. You actually have to blowtorch every particular spot of the oven for 7 minutes. That's if you hold it with a call. Do you need Libun Chazak, the strong making white, which is the strict position, or Libun Kal, the less level of heat. So that's a debate.
How safe is that? Like, they use the blowtorch? Like, what's the whole process?
Right, so, again, when you call in, there are koshering services done by typically by Chabad guys. They only use the Liban Chazak, and they will blowtorch your thing. And they've done it. It's fine. Your oven is pretty sturdy. It's not made out of tissue paper. But the best is really, is most modern ovens have a self-cleaning option, which, of course, is awesome. Put it on, done. Goes up to 1,200 degrees.
It's so hot in the kitchen, though.
I understand that, but it burns everything off. Everything that's there is considered not halakhically significant. Moving right along. Microwaves, same thing. Because now, the challenge of microwave, remember, the microwave essentially is halakhically viewed as a pot. So if I take a plate and I have and the food and it fills up the plate with steam, I essentially have infuse flavor into the plastic there. So what you can do is you can they have these pot. What you do is you get yourself a microwave top. You see they sell them, so it keeps in the steam, and you can just run dairy and meat. If somebody's strafed, you just clean it up, make it let it sit for a day, put a cup of water, let it go for a cycle until it boils out, so it fills up the entire thing with steam. You got yourself a kosher. You basically kosher the microwave. Dishwashers. Dishwashers is a whole debate. Can I use a dishwasher? Can I use it for milk and meat? So Moshe Feinstein says you could. Dairy, then meat. Provided that you had different racks. There's a whole debate about that. Most people would keep it for one, use it for one. But if it's an issue to run a cycle in between, there's room to negotiate. When you get to that situation, you give me a call. Next, sinks.
Wait, so if you only have one dishwasher?
I only have one dishwasher. Most people only have one dishwasher. But you typically only have a dishwasher for use it for stuff which is the most gunky food, which is meat, typically. People use it for, you know, Shabbos, so you can load it up, because you don't want to be washing all the dishes. You use it for meat.
So you use it just for meat? So
I just use it for meat. I do not use it for dairy. That would say, if you want to go the most common, luckily, solid position is that. If somebody's using for dairy than meat, it's not, I wouldn't call them, you know, non-kosher. I'm saying they're relying on a lenient position. Defensible, but lenient position.
Theoretically, when you put the dish in there, it's already cool.
Yeah, but you're going to spray it with very hot water. So the question is that the water is, and then there's water filling up on the bottom. So you have the flip. It's a whole issue. Now, here's the key thing. One of the redeeming things about the thing is that soap, detergent, has the capacity to kill the flavor initially. So if I take a plate and I have soap on it and I pour broiling hot water on it, that food becomes intrinsically non-food in 1 second, and therefore cannot infuse any flavor because it's disgusting. Who would like to have any kind of food which is mixed with Dawn detergent? It's intrinsically disgusting. Okay, so therefore it automatically cannot. It basically ensures that the flavor you kill it as it's no longer food anymore. And therefore can't trafe anything up. So there's a whole debate about when does hot water thing. Because usually it sprays the water, the wand sprays it first. So therefore it's still good, still theoretically good. Didn't put any detergent. The detergent gets released later. Okay, I don't want to go into the whole mechanics of dishwashers, but that's a basic deal. What else?
Sinks.
Sinks you got to be a little careful about. There's one way that you can avoid any kind of problem. If you don't use really hot water, what do I mean by really hot water? In other words, the water becomes an issue if it's so hot that your hand recoils because it's so hot. If water's not that hot, it can't be a medium of cooking, really. It's not cooking, you know what I mean? So if you use like moderately hot water, or some people like to really like put on those heavy plastic gloves and put it on really hot, and they're like going in there, right? That could be a lot. So therefore, if I have dairy meat, and I'm cooking and I'm washing the things in the same thing, that'd be a problem. Most people have one sink. You have a dairy rack, you have a meat rack, and you know, you just when you're, you know, you, so therefore the rack allows the stuff not to sit on the actual sink bottom. And because if you, in the case, you use the hot, very hot water and you didn't use the soap, you're not going to have a problem.
Do you have separate racks? So when you're using, like...
Yeah, meat
things,
meat,
your
dairy
rack, and you take it out, and...
Yeah, your dairy rack, yes.
Why can't you just have one rack and put dairy on the...
On the bottom?
Right, and then use the rack for meat.
Sometimes it backs up and the water rises. But again, if you have not hot, super hot water and you use detergent, you're not going to trafe anything up. Because you don't have water, hot water, which is the medium of endowing flavor. It's not available. And also the detergent makes the flavor dead because you automatically make it disgusting. Okay? So.
And I heard you need also kosher even a faucet, right?
If as far as kosher, yeah. Koshering the faucet.
If you just put it to the bottom.
I mean, if again, well, so how do you kosher a sink? So you kosher, you make it perfectly clean, maybe, you know, Brillo it, make sure there's no residual stuff, let it sit for a day, not used for any hot water, any water, hot substance. You take, let's say, a hot water kettle, one of the things, and you pour water with a call, the same water, because it gets hot water poured on it, so you put hot water on the entire surface, and that's it. And it's very simple. Kosher is very simple.
If you have everything new,
yeah.
Do you have to kosher? Or
nothing.
Just
Tovel. Tovel, it's the best.
So theoretically, if you moved into an apartment with a brand new kitchen, you don't need to kosher the oven.
Nothing.
Or like that.
Nothing. Awesome. That's why people like to do. Orthodox Jews like to move into a place when.
Renovated.
Yeah, a brand new. You know, they'll say a renovated kitchen into a home, right for Pesach. So then they can just go right into it. So then they use it for Pesach, and then they use it for the rest of the thing. So they don't have to do anything. Sweet.
Are there really more moves right before Pesach than any other time of the year?
For Orthodox Jews, yeah. Because it's a move. Because it's less work. People are lazy. That's it. All right, refrigerator. Okay, this is Rabbi Feldman brought a couple of things a year. Look, the bottom line is that everything's cold in the refrigerator. Look, obviously you got to be careful. Things spill. You know, things spill on racks. Okay, if you have milk and it's spill, you know, obviously you're going to put your, let's say you take your meat pot, which is still hot from the stove top, and you put it down on a glass surface where there's a layer of congealed milk, you're going to have a lot of problem with that pot because you're putting something broiling hot onto a little lake of milk is going to be a lot of problem. Okay, so. So what you do is something. If you bring something hot, you lay down like a towel and put it on the rack.
Or just clean your refrigerator.
Or you can be very meticulous about cleaning it.
Why does the outside matter? Doesn't it matter?
No, because it's very hot, it will cause the it'll heat up the milk that the milk will be absorbed into the bottom of the pot, and so your pot will partake of the flavor of meat and the flavor of dairy, and that's now what they call a tray pot. The content inside is fine, but it's a problem. Again, if I'm talking about something you're taking right from the oven, people sometimes, you know, certainly when I was involved in catering, you had these walk-in refrigerators, so they would take stuff and just like bazillion degrees hot, just put it on the rack, and it, you know, it's no problem. Something people are concerned about, you know, a small refrigerator will hurt the motor, da da, because it's going to be so hot. People like to let it sit out on the counter for a little bit before putting it in the refrigerator, but just something to either be fastidious about cleanliness. Or B, you just put down some paper towels or whatever cloth down there. Okay. All right. So application. When we went. Okay. So these are. So therefore, let's say you take over a timeshare, go on vacation to sunny Hawaii, and you're going to be at the timeshare for a week. You want to use the facilities. No problem. So if it's a stovetop, very simple. If it's an oven top, if it's like electric, you turn on the thing until it's red hot, 5 minutes, done, kosher, done. It's red hot, done. Then you can just put your stuff right on there. It's generally very clean, not to worry about, because they typically give you the timeshare clean. The oven is a little bit of pain. If it's self-clean, you do a self-cleaning oven. If it's not, then I would just not bother. I just put down, lay down some tinfoil on the actual, underneath the tray of stuff that I'm heating up. If it's something that splatters and I put something on top, if it doesn't splatter, I'll keep it open. If I'm going to use the sink, I'm not going to kosher the sink. I'm just going to not use super hot water because I'm lazy. So pots and pans you can't use. You use glass for cold. By the way, you can use their stuff for cold, even though it's non-kosher. You can use what they call Ekroi occasionally. Non-kosher. Let's say you go into you're on a business trip, and the business and the suite that you have been staying to has a little kitchenette, has a kitchenette, and you want to use, let's say, the bowl for a bowl of cereal. You can use that. You want to use their spoon, their metal spoon. So since it's Ekroi, since occasionally it's not your stuff, you're only going to be there for 1-2 days. You can use all their stuff for cold. For cold. You can't use your non-kosher pot to make something, obviously. But you can use their glass. You can use their bowls and their spoons for cereal. And cold items are cold. Man, again, we're assuming everything's perfectly clean.
What about their coffee machines? If you just run
coffee machine
through,
definitely. Coffee machine
run
definitely. Through,
run.
You don't have to run through it at all.
It's just coffee.
Because it's not used for anything else. It's make, you can use a It's kosher. It's kosher. Even one could argue, so even using the using the kashbot, no problem.
So then why for Pesach do we, is it just because it's Pesach? It's
Pesach like, people are extra strict. Technically you could. If you know for sure someone's only used for coffee, not flavored, which it could have possibly used for 100% coffee. Might be an issue of chametz, not an issue of non-kosher.
Oh, chametz, yeah.
Yeah, so that and that itself is what they call it. By Pesach, we're more strict. Okay. All right, so that's the bottom line. This is giving you a basic overview of some of the issues. But one thing you see that clearly is that running a kosher kitchen, assuming that your supplies are kosher, is not such a big deal. If you make mistakes, koshering is not so difficult. And, you know, it's a pretty stress-free situation. You know what I'm saying? Look, there's things that come up. One thing, something that is worthwhile mentioning, Rebecca brought up, if things are, you can infuse flavor with something which is super sharp, like an onion. So that's why we have parve cutting boards and parve knives, because if you cut an onion with a meat chef knife, even if it's not used for 24 hours, it's defined as absorbed the flavor of the meat, and you can't use it with dairy. Okay, so therefore you'll notice you go into a kosher home, they'll have a parve cutting board and parve knife cutting of the sharp, such as onions, such as radishes, such as lemons, things that have a very sharp flavor.
That's why the issue
is
at bars also.
Right, as far as the issue of... now again, if it's the only thing they're cutting up is lemons, it's not really a problem. Yeah, that's that can be a problem. Okay. All right, so let's just give you a little over, a little practical. Again, we want to mix it up with some theoretical conversation and then very practical stuff. Okay?
I'll go to Shira's question or point that Shira said. So if you go to a bar that potentially is attached to a restaurant that serves food, but you don't have a drink that has any... lemons or limes in it, it's fine, right?
The lemons might be, if they're cutting a lot of lemons, it might be fine. If they have a special lemon knife they only use to cut the lemons at the bar, they may not go into the, if you can see that they have their own little, if they're only cutting their own